Chapter 58. Fool surprised for his host. He was a systematic man, and did it in his usual thorough way. He sent a private and confidential suggestion to 150 of Mark Twain's friends and admirers, nearly all distinguished literary men. The suggestion was that each one of them should send a request for Mark Twain's autograph, timing it so that it would arrive on the 1st of April. All seemed to have responded. Mark Twain's writing table on April Fool morning was heaped with letters, asking in every ridiculous fashion for his allowable autograph. The one from Aldrich was a fair sample. He wrote, "I am making a collection of autographs of our distinguished writers, and having read one of your works, Gabriel Convoy, I would like to add your name to the list." Of course, the joke in this was that Gabriel Convoy was by Bret Harte, who by this time was thoroughly detested by Mark Twain. The first one or two of the letters puzzled the victim, then he comprehended the size and character of the joke, and entered into it thoroughly. One of the letters was from Bloodgood H. Cutter, the et lariat of Innocence Abroad. Cutter, of course, wrote in entry, that is to say, doggerel. Mark Twain's April Fool was a most pleasant one. Rhymed letter by Bloodgood H. Cutter to Mark Twain. Little Neck, Long Island. Long Island farmer, to his friend and pilgrim brother, Samuel 50. Clemens, Esk. Friends, suggest in each one's behalf to write, and ask your autograph. To refuse that, I will not do, after the long voyage had with you. That was a memorable time you wrote in prose, I wrote in rhyme, to describe the wonders of each place, and the queer customs of each race. That is in my memory yet for while I live I'll not forget. I often think of that affair, and the many that were with us there. As your friends think it for the best I ask your autograph with the rest, hoping you will it to me send twill please and cheer your dear old friend. Yours truly, Bloodgood H. Cutter. To W. D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, Ablate, 84. My dear Howells, it took my breath away, and I haven't recovered it yet, entirely I mean the generosity of your proposal, to read the proofs of Huck Finn. Now if you mean it, old man, if you are in earnest, proceed, in God's name, and be by me forever blessed. I cannot conceive of a rational man deliberately piling such an atrocious job upon himself. But if there is such a man, and you be that man, why then pile it on. It will cost me a pang every time I think of it, but this anguish will be incubus to me in the joy and comfort I shall get out of the not having to read the Verfluchtheat proofs myself. But if you have repented of your augenblicliture topsicht, and got back to calm cold reason again, I won't hold you to it, unless I find I have got you down in writing somewhere. Here, I would not read the proof of one of my books for any fair and reasonable sum whatever, if I could get out of it. The proof reading on the P&P cost me the last rags of my religion. M. Howells had written that he would be glad to help out in the reading of the proofs of Huck Finn, which book Webster by this time had in hand. Replying to Clemens' eager and grateful acceptance now, he wrote, "It is all perfectly true about the generosity, unless I am going to read your proofs from one of the shabby motives which I always find at the bottom of my soul, if I examine it. A characteristic utterance, though we may be permitted to believe, that his shabby motives were fewer and less shabby than those of mankind in general." The proofs which Howells was reading pleased him mightily. Once, during the summer, he wrote, "If I had written half as good a book as Huck Finn I shouldn't ask anything better than to read the proofs. Even as it is, I don't, so send them on. They will always find me somewhere." This was the summer of the Blaine Cleveland campaign. Mark Twain, in company with many other leading men, had mugwumped, and was supporting Cleveland. From the next letter we gather something of the aspects of that memorable campaign, which was one of scandal and vituperation. We learn, too, that the young sculptor, Carl Gerhardt, having completed a 3-year study in Paris, had returned to America a qualified artist. To W. D. Howells, in Boston. Elmira, August 21, 84. My dear owls, this presidential campaign is too delicious for anything. Isn't human nature the most consummate sham and lie that was ever invented? Isn't man a creature to be ashamed of in pretty much all his aspects? Man, know thyself, and then thou wilt despise thyself, to a dead moral certainty. Take three quite good specimens, Holly, Warner, and Charlie Clark. Even I do not loathe Blaine more than they do. Yet Holly is howling for Blaine, Warner, and Clark are eating their daily crow in the paper for him, and all three will vote for him. O stultification, where is thy sting? O slave, where is thy hickory? I suppose you heard how a marble monument for which St. Gaudens was pecuniarily responsible burned down in Hartford the other day, uninsured, for who in the world would ever think of insuring a marble shaft in a cemetery against a fire? And left St. Gaudens out of pocket $15,000. It was a bad day for artists. Gerhardt finished my bust that day, and the work was pronounced admirable by all the kin and friends, but in putting it in plaster, or rather taking it out, next day it got ruined. It was 4 or 5 weeks' hard work gone to the dogs. The news flew, and everybody on the farm flocked to the arbor, and grouped themselves about the wreck in a profound and moving silence. The farm help, the colored servants, the German nurse, the children, everybody, a silence interrupted at wide intervals by absent-minded ejaculations rising from unconscious breasts as the whole size of the disaster gradually worked its way home to the realization of one spirit after another. Some burst out with one thing, some another. The German nurse put up her hands and said, "Oh, Schade, oh, Schrecklich." But Gerhardt said nothing, or almost that. He couldn't word it, I suppose. But he went to work, and by dark, had everything thoroughly well underway for a fresh start in the morning, and in 3 days' time had built a new bust which was a trifle better than the old one, and tomorrow we shall put the finishing touches on it, and it will be about as good a one as nearly anybody can make. Ears ever mark. If you run across anybody who wants a bust, be sure and recommend Gerhardt on my say-so. But Owls was determinedly for Blaine. "Shall vote for Blaine," he replied. "Do not believe he is guilty of the things they accuse him of, and I know they are not proved against him. As for Cleveland, his private life may be no worse than that of most men, but as an enemy of that contemptible, hypocritical, lopsided morality which says a woman shall suffer all the shame of unchastity and man none, I want to see him destroyed politically by his past. The men who defend him would take their wives to the White House, if he were president, but if he married his concubine, made her an honest woman, they would not go near him. I can't stand that." Certainly this was sound logic, in that day, at least. But it left Clemens far from satisfied. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Elmira, September 17, 84. "My dear Owls, somehow I can't seem to rest quiet under the idea of your voting for Blaine. I believe you said something about the country and the party. Certainly allegiance to these as well, but as certainly a man's first duty is to his own conscience and honor, the party, or the country, come second to that, and never first. I don't ask you to vote at all, I only urge you to not soil yourself by voting for Blaine. When you wrote before, you were able to say the charges against him were not proven. But you know now that they are proven, and it seems to me that that bars you and all other honest and honorable men who are independently situated from voting for him. It is not necessary to vote for Cleveland. The only necessary thing to do, as I understand it, is that a man shall keep himself clean by withholding his vote for an improper man, even though the party and the country go to destruction in consequence. It is not parties that make or save countries or that build them to greatness. It is clean men, clean ordinary citizens, rank and file, the masses. Clean masses are not made by individuals standing back till the rest become clean. As I said before, I think a man's first duty is to his own honor, not to his country, and not to his party. Don't be offended. I mean no offense. I am not so concerned about the rest of the nation, but well, goodbye. It's ever Mark. There does not appear to be any further discussion of the matter between Owls and Clemens. Their letters for a time contain no suggestion of politics. Perhaps Mark Twain's own political conscience was not entirely clear in his repudiation of his party. At least we may believe from his next letter that his Cleveland enthusiasm was qualified by a willingness to support a Republican who would command his admiration and honor. The idea of an 11th hour nomination was rather startling, whatever its motive. To Mr. Pierce, in Boston. Hartford, October 22, 84. My dear Mr. Pierce, you know, as well as I do, that the reason the majority of Republicans are going to vote for Blaine is because they feel that they cannot help themselves. Do not you believe that, if Mr. Edmonds would consent to run for president, on the independent ticket even at this late day he might be elected? Well, if he wouldn't consent, but should even strenuously protest and say he wouldn't serve if elected, isn't it still wise and fair to nominate him and vote for him? Since his protest would relieve him from all responsibility, and he couldn't surely find fault with people for forcing a compliment upon him. And do not you believe that his name thus compulsorily placed at the head of the independent column would work absolutely certain defeat to Blaine and save the country's honor? Politicians often carry a victory by springing some disgraceful and rascally mine under the feet of the adversary at the 11th hour. Would it not be wholesome to vary this thing for once and spring as formidable a mine of a better sort under the enemy's works? If Edmund's name were put up, I would vote for him in the teeth of all the protesting and blaspheming he could do in a month, and there are lots of others who would do likewise. If this notion is not a foolish and wicked one, won't you just consult with some chief independents, and see if they won't call a sudden convention and whoop the thing through? To nominate Edmunds the 1st of November would be soon enough, wouldn't it? With kindest regards to you and the Eldridges, ear truly S50. Clemens. Clemens and Cable set out on their reading tour in November. They were a curiously assorted pair. Cable was of orthodox religion, exact as to habits, neat, prim, all that Clemens was not. In the beginning Cable undertook to read the Bible aloud to Clemens each evening, but this part of the day's program was presently omitted by request. If they spent Sunday in a town, Cable was upright and early visiting the various churches and Sunday schools, while Mark Twain remained at the hotel, in bed, reading or asleep. XXV, The Great Year of 1885. Clemens and Cable. Publication of Huck Finn. The Grant Memoirs. Mark Twain at 50, the year 1885 was in some respects the most important, certainly the most pleasantly exciting, in Mark Twain's life. It was the year in which he entered fully into the publishing business, and launched one of the most spectacular of all publishing adventures, the personal memoirs of General U.S. Grant. Clemens had not intended to do general publishing when he arranged with Webster to become sales-agent for the Mississippi book, and later general agent for Huck Finn's adventures. He had intended only to handle his own books, because he was pretty thoroughly dissatisfied with other publishing arrangements. Even the Library of Humor, which Howells, with Clark, of the Courant, had put together for him, he left with Osgood until that publisher failed, during the spring of 1885. Certainly he never dreamed of undertaking anything of the proportions of the Grant book. He had always believed that Grant could make a book. More than once, when they had met, he had urged the general to prepare his memoirs for publication. Howells, in his My Mark Twain, tells of going with Clemens to see Grant, then a member of the ill-fated firm of Grant and Ward, and how they lunched on beans, bacon and coffee brought in from a nearby restaurant. It was while they were eating this soldier fare that Clemens, very likely abetted by Howells, especially urged the great commander to prepare his memoirs. But Grant had become a financier, as he believed, and the prospect of literary earnings, however large, did not appeal to him. Furthermore, he was convinced that he was without literary ability, and that a book by him would prove a failure. But then, by and by, came a failure more disastrous than anything he had foreseen, the downfall of his firm through the Napoleonic rascality of Ward. General Grant was utterly ruined. He was left without income and apparently without the means of earning one. It was the period when the Great War series was appeasing in the Century magazine. General Grant, hard-pressed, was induced by the editors to prepare one or more articles, and, finding that he could write them, became interested in the idea of a book. It is unnecessary to repeat here the story of how the publication of this important work passed into the hands of Mark Twain, that is to say, the firm of Charles 50, Webster & Company, the details having been fully given elsewhere. See Mark Twain. A Biography, Chap. Cliff. We will now return for the moment to other matters, as reported in order by the letters. Clemens and Cable had continued their reading tour into Canada, and in February found themselves in Montreal. Here they were invited by the Tokelau Snowshoe Club to join in one of their weekly excursions across Mountain Royal. They could not go, and the reasons given by Mark Twain are not without interest. The letter is to Mr. George Isles, author of Flame, Electricity, and the Camera, and many other useful works. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.